I think the way the Mises U schedule works is that every year they print out last year's schedule and they glance at it and they say, all right, this will keep, this will change, whatever. And I think they just forgot about this one because I gave this one last year, and it's more or less dealing with the financial crisis. And some of you know I wrote a book on this meltdown several years ago. I am so tired of talking about the financial crisis. I can't begin to tell you. I mean, if I hear Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac one more time, I'm going to commit an unbelievable atrocity. However, for the Mises Institute, I'll do anything. Okay, that's what they want me to talk about, then their wish is my command. So I am going to change things up a bit from last year. So for those of you who spend your lives watching previous year's Mises U videos and comparing them and saying, well, gee, this year, when Herbener talked on value theory, he used a slightly different example. You'll find that this presentation is a lot different from the one that I gave last year. So I'm going to sort of do two things in the time today. The first thing I'll do is try and give a brief kind of a overview of the financial crisis and the housing thing, but just the basics, because I think some of you probably know this stuff. And if it whets your appetite, then of course you can always, you know, pick up a copy of Meltdown. Okay? And then the second thing I'm going to do after I do that, I want to then give more of a bird's eye view of the subject. Instead of delving into the details of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, oh, there I go again. There I said it. Uh-oh. Once I do that, I want to give a bird's eye view of crises in general and some of the features they have in common and just give you a way to think about them and review some of the proposed rationales for intervention in the wake of a crisis. Why do governments believe that it's necessary for them to intervene in the wake of a crisis? Why do they believe that they can't just sit and wait and let the crisis sort of resolve itself? Like, what are the rationales they give? And we'll explore those in brief and try and see if we can come up with replies to them. Okay, so first I'm going to just give a little bit of background on what led up to this. And so this also yields you another. I'm not really just selling books here, I promise you. I don't make anything on this book anymore. I got more of an advance than I will ever earn on the actual sales. But this book, Rollback, is probably the most ridiculous title I have. And I have some dumb titles for my books. I mean, I've really set some records in terms of stupidity. But I think Rollback is just a horrifyingly bad title. But I couldn't come up with anything else. And the publisher said, it's too late. That's it. You're stuck with it. And when you look at that book, and every time I get people on the verge of buying it, you know, I say, don't look at the book cover. Don't read what's on the flap that makes it sound boring or makes it sound like a book against Obama. We're all against Obama. Then they get to Amazon and the description is so boring, I've lost them again. You know, like I'm just about to make the sale and they go to Amazon, they say, nope, forget it. So it's hard to sell this thing. But in there is where I talk more about the issue of regulation and deregulation, because that comes up. When you talk about the financial crisis, basically the conventional wisdom is this, that this is an example of the free market run amok. We were told this certainly by the Krugmans of the world, but we're even told it by people like Richard Posner, who's supposed to be our friend, or supposed to be like a distant cousin anyway. And Posner says in his book that this crisis was caused by pure laissez-faire. Like that was clearly the cause, and that it was caused by market actors behaving in a free market. And then you say to Posner, well, wait a minute. I mean, what about, for one thing, the Federal Reserve, right? I mean, that had something to do with the crisis. And his answer is the Federal Reserve is part of laissez-faire. It's part of American capitalism. So you can't possibly win because every bad thing then becomes part of capitalism. That's like, by definition, capitalism is bad things. So the... And this is our friend, our old friend, Richard Posner. Well, he hasn't been Walter Block's friend for some time, but the rest of us kind of thought we had something going with Richard Posner. So that sort of thing has got to be answered. So I did have time in that book to try to deal with those sorts of claims. So a lot of times people want to just get started by talking about what happened to these big financial institutions in 2008. Like what we saw investment banks get in big trouble and incredible transformations of Wall Street that we saw. But this is really getting ahead of ourselves. I mean, the question isn't why did they fall? The question, first of all, is why did they rise so high? Where did this all come from? And in this crisis, of course, housing plays a central role, as you all know. So we tend to look there. And I would like to pledge right now that this is the last time in my career I am going to talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'm never going to talk about them again. That's it. I'm sick of it. No one wants to hear them. You want to throw rocks at people who mention them. They were so-called government-sponsored enterprises. So that is to say, they were not government-owned or run, but they were not, at the same time, purely private institutions either. They had all manner of special tax and regulatory advantages not shared by other institutions. They had a special lifeline to the U.S. Treasury, a special credit line. And it was more or less taken for granted that if it ever came to that, that line of credit with the Treasury would be more or less unlimited. And that seems to have been the basis on which they acted. I've got some juicy quotations from executives at Freddie Mac more or less saying that, we knew all along that if housing really collapsed, that the federal government would have our back. So it's not like they were saying we were really worried that we would have to stand or fall on our own merits. Now, they didn't really have that illusion. So, no, it wasn't an explicit bailout guarantee. It was a wink, wink, nudge, nudge bailout guarantee. So these institutions became the primary purchasers of mortgage loans. And so you have these products, by the way. I mean, I assume people very much against their will during the crisis became knowledgeable about mortgage-backed securities. But these are products that one might buy that entitle you to a fraction of the stream of mortgage payments that are coming from a variety of home mortgages that have been bundled together into an instrument like this. And so Fannie and Freddie would buy these mortgages, buy these products, and then make investment vehicles out of them, in effect. And in fact, I think our own home mortgage, when we had a mortgage on one of our houses, was actually bought by Fannie Mae. We got a letter saying that such and such bank down the street doesn't hold your mortgage anymore. Fannie Mae holds it. So that's what it means. And they were the most frequent buyers. And so if Fannie and Freddie had not stood ready to buy a lot of these mortgages from the banks, many of them would not have been extended in the first place. So, for example, Countrywide, which was an example of a bank that got into big trouble, sold about 90% of its loans to Fannie and Freddie. And so Fannie and Freddie now would be entitled to the stream of payments, and then the banks would get the dough from Fannie and Freddie. Now, there was an incentive. There was an incentive for banks to do this. And the incentive, it turns out, can be identified with what are called sometimes called prudential regulations or capital requirements. So if you had extended a traditional loan, any old type of loan, it was understood that you had to hold, let's say you extended a loan for $100, some just ordinary loan, $100. You had to hold $10 in capital against that loan. If you made a real estate loan, you had to hold only $5 in capital. So you could lend out 95 and only hold 5. If you bought a AAA rated mortgage backed security, which is just thought to be, can't possibly fail, you only had to hold $2 in reserve for every $100. So the incentive, therefore, was to rush into this type of asset so that you would only have to hold such a small amount of capital. And in fact, the real incentive was to extend a mortgage loan to somebody and then sell it, to package it, have it be packaged and sold, and then get rid of that mortgage and then buy it back, in effect, in the form of a mortgage-backed security. And then you could lend out more because the capital requirement was lower if you had a mortgage-backed security as opposed to a traditional real estate loan on your books. So all the incentives were in place for banks to do this. And as a result, there was a massive flight into this type of asset. And normally, you would think there would be more of a distribution among asset classes in terms of some of these financial institutions' portfolios. But when regulatory arbitrage encourages institutions to buy one particular asset at the expense of others, it's no surprise that they all cluster into this one kind. And then when this particular type of asset turned out to be of far lower quality than people believed, then you have a big problem on your hands because a whole lot of institutions are holding on to them. And that's what we wound up seeing. Fannie and Freddie tended to be quite willing to take risks and to absorb risky mortgages. The CEO of Fannie Mae actually said in emails that we now have, thanks to the NSA, I don't know how we got these emails, but he told employees to get aggressive on risk taking or get out of the company. And they listened to that, apparently, as it turns out. In fact, also, we heard a lot during the crisis of leverage, and that a lot of firms were highly leveraged, which means that their strategy was based on borrowing an awful lot of money and using that borrowed money to buy high-powered assets. Well, Fannie and Freddie were as leveraged as anybody, more leveraged than the major investment banks were. Their leverage ratio was about 60 to 1. So they had $83 billion in capital covering $5 trillion in liabilities. So in mid-2008, they are really getting in major, major trouble. And Hank Paulson, who was that's sort of a blast from the past, remember, an old Treasury secretary from the old days. Hank Paulson was asked, well, what do you think about this? Are they in trouble or are they adequately capitalized? And Paulson said, quote, their regulator has made clear that they are adequately capitalized. And then 2 months later, basically the federal government nationalizes them and Paulson is back on TV and this is quoted back at him. Didn't you just tell us in July that their regulator, you know, that you said they're adequately capitalized? And he said, no. He said, this is what he said. I never said the company was well capitalized. What I said is the regulator said they are adequately capitalized. And I guess that is technically true. That is indeed what he said. But some people, sticklers, might think that that was a misleading statement. But okay, so but what's interesting, though, is what reveals that people more or less knew that there may as well have been an explicit bailout guarantee for Fannie and Freddie if some of these loans really began to go bad, was how cheaply they were able to borrow. I mean, the U.S. government is considered to be a very low risk of bankruptcy. And so the U.S. government can borrow super-duper cheaply. Well, pretty much Fannie and Freddie were able to borrow at 1 percentage point higher than the U.S. government was able to borrow at. And from 2000 to 2006, at a time when the risk element of Fannie and Freddie's holdings was growing substantially, their borrowing costs held steady with those of the U.S. government or even fell in relation to the U.S. government. So that should make clear that people who actually had skin in the game also thought that there was no chance that Fannie and Freddie would just be allowed to go under. Well, we look at all the different institutions that had any type of hand in housing, and that would include Fannie and Freddie, yes, but also the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Federal Housing Administration, or FHA, the Federal Reserve. All these institutions were all putting out orders that banks have got to extend loans in circumstances that they wouldn't normally extend them, and they need to be much more liberal in their loan origination. They need to be willing to extend no-doc mortgages, which means somebody just comes in and says, I'd like to get a mortgage loan, and you say, well, do you have a job? And they say, yeah, and then that's it. Like, there's no letter from their boss or, you know, a stub from their paycheck or anything. And that's just sort of okay. And so this sort of thing was being done repeatedly. And then the FHA, meanwhile, the FHA's programs were supposed to help low-income people become homeowners. So under Bill Clinton, the secretary of HUD broadened the scope of what the FHA was doing and doubled the upper limit of FHA loans. So FHA loans could guarantee up to $235,000 in the 1990s in terms of mortgage loans. You only had to put 3% down. And then the Bush administration pushed this ahead even farther, more and more and more. And so all these institutions are pushing on housing lenders or are themselves engaged in practices that would have been considered laughable in previous years. So the result of this was without even getting into the Federal Reserve, with more and more people going into home ownership, this is going to push up housing prices. And then, of course, the role of Greenspan is going to be evident as well. But this is going to push up housing prices. And the higher housing prices then leads to a kind of a feedback loop, because now that housing prices have been bid up because people get all these special privileges, so now they're if you only have to put 3% down or 0% down, more people will do it. So there's greater demand. More people want to get into the housing market. More people specifically want to get into home ownership. Well, that makes the prices of houses go up. And when the prices of houses go up, now people say, well, I need a bigger loan in order to be able to get into a house. I need easier terms for the loan. I need the banking institutions to be more lax in what they require of me. And so it just feeds into itself. In fact, it's the same sort of thing we see with education. The federal government gets involved in education and makes all these programs available, particularly subsidized loans, to students. And then this pushes up the price of education, which then in turn makes the students demand more loans, which makes education get more expensive, then we need more loans. And this is what the federal government calls affordable education or affordable housing. It's not that the prices come down. What are you, some kind of simpleton? If you think of affordability means low prices, it doesn't mean low prices. It means sky-high prices, but we'll extend you loans that will make you a debt slave for the rest of your life so you can afford it. That's what they mean by affordable. They don't actually mean that the price comes down. And so the statistics are just unbelievable in terms of how much, how many mortgages you had, people with no down payments or no doc mortgages and so on. So then after 2008 comes along and we started to see defaults and major problems occurring, people began to notice that the FHA in 2008 with the housing market in dire straits is continuing to back risky loans and low down payment loans. And just in a matter of a couple of years, the FHA had gone from guaranteeing 2% of mortgages to over 20% of mortgages. And the stimulus of 2008 included a provision that said that the maximum loan that the FHA can insure is now $729,750. This is to help low-income people buy houses. And before I came up here, I asked Bob Murphy, is there any possible rationale that the FHA, which exists for low-income people, is there any conceivable reason that they could have for insuring a house that sells for almost $730,000? Like, is there some big thing that I'm not getting? And it was hard to think of an innocent explanation for this, but this sort of thing just went on. And people, well, that's just the way it goes. That's how the government is. So what you had then were all these various, and there are many others as well, but all these various pressures that tended to increase the extent to which people were interested in home ownership specifically as opposed to renting or, you know, living with their parents or whatever they were doing before. Now they want to all go out and take advantage of these programs. But then you combine that with an expansionary monetary policy, and a lot of that money then is going to tend to go into the housing market because this is sort of the big thing. In fact, I'm probably not being as elegant as he would be, but Professor Garrison has sometimes said that a lot of times when you look at the Austrian business cycle, in particular cases, you'll notice that in the 1990s, for instance, it was dot-com stocks that were particularly distorted. Or, you know, sometimes you'll see there's a particular area that's especially distorted. And so it's like the expansionary monetary policy is like piggybacking on whatever the big thing is, it then latches onto and distorts. And that seems to have been what happened in this particular case. But in this case, it was housing. So now, given that you have heard much about the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and we had a plenary talk about it from Professor Garrison, and I've got a gazillion YouTube videos on it, I'm not going to go into that here, except to say this, that in 2001, we had, well, of course, we had 9/11, and we had a mild recession that was still going on, hadn't had a robust recovery yet from the dot-com bust. And so with these ingredients hovering over his head, Greenspan came to the conclusion that this was a year that we needed lower interest rates. So we got about 11 interest rate cuts in 2001 alone. And it's interesting to note, as Mark Thornton observes, that this is the first recession on record in which housing starts actually went up instead of down. And housing prices went considerably higher rather than lower. And so people did draw conclusions from this. They drew the conclusion that no matter what happens to the economy, real estate seems to come out smelling like roses. So this is where we really need to cluster our money. We need to hurry into real estate, because even when things come crashing down, real estate is robust. And so instead of people maybe rethinking their expenditures or their investment strategy, or is real estate really an investment, or asking themselves deep, profound questions like this, they really didn't re-examine their behavior. They just doubled down on it. They continued. And so when the crash finally came, people were much more deeply invested in real estate than they would otherwise have been. And so all that was done was that the day of reckoning was delayed by some years. Now, what about, though, wasn't all this bank lending and irresponsible lending and all these sorts of deformities that we see in the economy, wasn't this all caused by deregulation? Wasn't this caused by the absence of a firm hand guiding the economy, that if only we had had that, then maybe this could have been prevented? Well, that indeed is the conventional wisdom, but the difficulty with this claim is that it's actually very hard to find cases of deregulation that are actually relevant to what happened. You can find some avenues of deregulation. For example, about a little over 30 years ago, there was an act of deregulation that removed the limitation on interest rates on savings accounts. Now banks could offer whatever rates they wanted, or more or less. Well, it seems like kind of a stretch to say that 30 years later, that would cause a financial crisis. It doesn't even seem like there's any cause and effect relationship there, but that was one part of deregulation. Removing restrictions on interstate branch banking was another aspect of deregulation. So you could have a branch in Nebraska and in New Mexico. Okay, but again, it's not immediately obvious why that would be a source of difficulty. So in other words, what the deregulation that did occur seems to have been more or less irrelevant. Now, the objection that one might advance here is, well, what about this Glass-Steagall thing we hear a lot about? Right? There was, in 1999, there was the partial repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, and this caused it. Well, you get this a lot, but even the Washington Post not long ago published an article saying, the Glass-Steagall thing is a total myth and a red herring. The Glass-Steagall was a law that was supposed to put a kind of a firewall between investment banking and commercial banking. So commercial banks are allowed to do certain things, and investment banks are allowed to do certain things, and never the twain shall meet. And they would not be allowed to be owned by the same parent company, could not have both an investment banking part and a commercial banking part. That was forbidden. The partial repeal of this in 1999 removed only this latter provision, that you can't, a single holding company can't have both an investment bank and a commercial bank at the same time. That was removed. That restriction was removed. That was the partial repeal. Does this explain, then, the financial crisis? Does this explain what we observed? Well, for one thing, it's worth noting that a lot of times people who are not supporters of the free market will point to Canada as a great example of a place where they got through better than the U.S. did, and that's because they were more heavily regulated. And yet, Canada did not have a Glass-Steagall restriction, as did, indeed, if you look at Europe, by and large, you don't see these restrictions there. So that doesn't seem to be, just prima facie, the explanation. But also, three institutions that were really at the heart of this, Bear Stearns, Lehman, and Merrill Lynch, were just pure investment banks. So Glass-Steagall is irrelevant to these. Glass-Steagall is irrelevant to Goldman Sachs. It's irrelevant to AIG, which was an investment firm. It's irrelevant to New Century Financial. And when we look at Wachovia and Washington Mutual, they just made risky loans to homeowners. That's what brought them under. It was no special privilege that the partial repeal of Glass-Steagall had made available to them that led them into this behavior. They were just, what the banks did was not some newfangled thing that they were suddenly allowed to do. They were always allowed to have to buy securitized loans and all that stuff. It was that they did old-fashioned bank things really badly. They made bad lending decisions. Bank of America got into serious trouble, but largely because, not because it bought an investment bank, but because it bought Countrywide, which was a traditional mortgage lender. Also, it's worth noting the statistics on the regulatory bodies themselves. The regulatory bodies actually saw their statistics go up in terms of how many people were employed there, what their budgets were. Bob Murphy did some good work on this, but the SEC, for example, its funding under George W. Bush increased at an 11.3% annualized rate as compared to a 6.8% rate under Bill Clinton, and its staff grew at 1% per year. Under Jimmy Carter, its staff fell by 1.2% per year. Spending on the regulatory agencies in charge has tripled since so-called deregulation began around 1980. And then the BU economist, Larry Kotlikoff, he's the guy who in addition to other things, estimates the total of the capitalized value of the unfunded liabilities of the transfer programs. He's the one who comes up with the most recent figure is $222 trillion. Well, he also investigated how many state and federal agencies are there in charge of financial regulation. Answer is 115. And he sort of playfully suggests that it may be the case that just increasing that figure to 116 might not really solve the problem. Like maybe it wasn't that 115 was just one too few, and now if we have another one, then this won't happen. Maybe it could be that there is such a thing as the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and that trying to regulate it out of existence is chasing after, you know, it's trying to go to the barn when the horse has already left. It'd catch a train that's already left the station. I mean, that's pretty much the analogy. And as we noted, some of the regulations themselves had perverse incentives, namely the capital requirements. There's a lot more that can be said on this regulation thing. I've talked about it in YouTubes and in Rollback. But then we had the bailouts. We were told that, well, this is such a severe crisis. We're seeing major institutions who now have assets on their books that they thought were super duper, but now turn out to be not super duper, and therefore we need to bail them out. And if we don't bail them out, then there's going to be a terrible contagion from one bad institution to another, and it's just going to be a cascade, and there'll be a domino effect, and everything will collapse, and certainly you stupid rubes don't want that. So shut your mouths and let us formulate this bailout policy. So, for instance, I won't go through TARP. There's plenty of stuff written on that, but although I remember when the House initially voted against that, and the establishment media and people came on TV, and it was like their dog had just died. And they were talking like they can't. Who do these rotten upstart uppity nobodies think they are to vote against something that their betters have told them they all need? And everybody, every respectable person in all the financial papers, all the free market, so-called free market people, they're all saying, well, we got to make an exception. We can't be extremists here. Got to make an exception. You know, George W. Bush said, I have to suspend the free market to save the free market and all that. And that was the conventional wisdom. Paul Ryan is begging people on the House floor, oh my goodness, you got to just do whatever they say and everything's going to be terrible. They all did that. They all went for that. Except a noble few, okay? A noble few stood up and said, nope, I don't buy it. Well, AIG, this insurance company, and in fact, it's either my wife or I, we actually have life insurance through AIG. Their insurance branch is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. And in fact, 90% of AIG was perfectly solvent, so there was no reason that AIG couldn't have just gone through normal bankruptcy proceedings. And then later, one of its former CEO of AIG came along and said, you know what, on second thought, it might have been better if AIG had just gone through bankruptcy. Now, we had all said that maybe it should just go through bankruptcy, and we were told, you are not even entitled to live in civilized society for having an opinion like that. Now the guy comes along and says it. Well, I don't know, nobody apologized to us, but that's okay. We don't need that. But when we think, first of all, about the bailouts, remember that it's not like the amount of stuff in the economy collapsed during the crisis. The amount of stuff was the same. There was just as much lumber and steel and concrete as there was the day before. It's that people had overvalued certain assets, and it turns out their price actually should have been lower. So in bankruptcy, you will rearrange ownership titles to these various goods, but there's still just as much stuff as there was the day before. So we should bear that in mind. The stuff is the same. Well, David Stockman investigates this AIG thing in his great book, The Great Deformation, which I highly recommend. You'll love that book. It has such a punchy prose style. How can he sustain a punchy prose style for 700 pages or whatever it is? I don't know, but I just love it. I'm envious of his prose style. His prose style is like, you know, you ever heard that Orwellian image of a boot, you know, stepping on a human face forever? Well, I always loved that image. Well, this is the image for the Stockman book is a fist, you know, coming through the book right at your face. And it's not really a fist. He's not trying to punch you in the face. It's just in case, like, Hank Paulson happens to be sticking around, maybe he'll get it. But he says the problems with AIG, he says, would have been confined to Wall Street, would have fizzled out right there. So the claim that, well, we have to bail them out to save all the Main Street banks, he says, no, that is not true, because almost none of the problems with AIG had anything to do with any of the Main Street banks. AIG had problems with something called its credit default swap liabilities. Well, almost none of these busted CDS liabilities were held by Main Street banks. Who was holding them? Basically, about a dozen institutions. And these dozen institutions could have absorbed this hit. How do we know that? Because these dozen institutions held about $20 trillion in assets, and the losses they were going to take on this were about $60 billion. Now, that amounts to a few months' worth of bonuses. That's it. That was what was preserved by the bailout of AIG. And remember, they didn't have time even to talk to us about that. We don't even have time to listen to what you people are saying. The economy is collapsing, and if we don't supply these bonuses, if we don't bail out AIG, everything is going to... And you notice everything's rush, rush, rush. We don't have time to talk to you about it. Patriot Act, too dangerous to talk to you people about this. Got to just put it through. Bailouts, we don't have time to figure out who's actually exposed to AIG. Who needs to ask that? Just fork over the dough. And that's what happened. Or we were told money market mutual funds are collapsing. So again, we need a fresh bailout. We don't have time to talk to you people about this. You stupid rubes, you're not even entitled to an opinion. And this was because the Reserve Prime Fund broke the buck, which means that it went below a dollar a share. And that's a highly unusual thing. So who knows what will happen next? And so people are all taking their money out of money markets and they're putting it under their mattresses and it's terrible. Well, it actually turns out that isn't what was happening. People were taking their money out of riskier money markets and putting it in safer money markets. And people who did on net withdraw their money from money markets, which I did, by the way, just because I just finally thought, well, why am I holding all my money in this stupid money market that earns me like $1 every three centuries? So I actually took mine out, did something else with it. They basically put their money right back into the banking system, either into CDs or savings accounts and whatever. Then we had the case of John Mack, who was the CEO of Morgan Stanley. And John Mack is unhappy because people are short-selling his stock. Now, not everybody's going to know about short-selling, by the way. It's sort of lingo, but short-selling is like if you think a stock is going to go up in price, you buy that stock. Because then when it goes up in price, you'll own it, and you can sell it and collect the difference. But if you think a stock is going to fall in price, you short that stock. And the way you do it is you borrow the stock at the current higher price, and then you sell it at that price and collect the dough. And then when the stock price falls, you buy it back at the lower price and give it, then return it and keep the difference. So, for example, I borrow $100 worth of stock, and I sell it for $100. And then I wait for the price to go down, goes down to 60. I buy it for 60. I return it. Meanwhile, I keep the 40 bucks. So that's shorting a stock. Well, regulators don't typically like this because stock shorting tends to show them up because it's a way that a firm that's in trouble or a firm that's engaged in shady practices can be exposed just by average investors. And regulators don't like being shown up. And CEOs like John Mack don't like being shorted. So it's horrifying that his stock is being shorted by these terrible people on Wall Street. But actually, what was really happening was that his customers were just withdrawing their money because they thought John Mack was kind of a knucklehead. And so he calls up Washington, his buddies in Washington, and says, you got to put a lid on short selling. And he got what he asked for. For 15 days, the rule was you can buy all the financial company stock you want, but you are not allowed to sell it. So now there is no free market institution that could enforce something like that. So this is the government obviously and repeatedly helping the wealthiest people. And again, when you're dealing with cases where the difference between the government helping them and the government not helping them is just a few months' worth of bonuses, you know, to say, well, we just need different politicians. I mean, you just want to smash, I don't know what you want to smash. Somebody's head, I don't know what you want to do. We're not violent people. But 10 years earlier, 10 years before this even happened, the Fed had sent a pretty clear signal of what it was going to do in the future. When back in 1998, the Fed arranged for a bailout of a hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management. Now, I talked about this in Rollback, and then more recently in Stockman's book, he says this. Long-term capital management was an egregious financial train wreck that had amassed leverage ratios of 100 to 1 in order to fund giant speculative bets in currency, equity, bond, and derivatives markets around the globe. The sheer recklessness and scale of long-term capital management speculations had no parallel in American financial history. Long-term capital management stunk to high heaven and had absolutely no claim on public authority, resources, or even sympathy. And this was the hedge fund that the Fed decided, well, this thing can't be allowed to go. We have to arrange for a bailout of it. So over the next 15 months, after the bailout of long-term capital management in 1998, the S&P 500 went up by 50% in 15 months. 5-0, 50% in 15 months. So did this mean that American companies were now seeing their profit outlooks increase by half? Is that what was meant by the S&P 500 going up by 50%? No, according to Stockman, what it actually means is that it showed how confident these firms were that the Fed was going to step in to prevent the usual free market punishment of firms that had made unwise decisions. So he said that these stock market averages reflected, quote, expected monetary juice from the central bank, not anticipated growth of profits from free market enterprises. So, and it wasn't just specific firms that we're talking about here that were going to benefit from the chairmanship of Alan Greenspan or his successors. Stockman talks about something he called the wealth effect. And what's meant by that is that if the Fed can manage to push stock prices higher, this will make Americans feel wealthier. They'll look at their stock portfolios and say, look at how well I'm doing. My stock prices are increasing, and this will make Americans more liable to spend and borrow. And that will stimulate economic activity. Now, that doesn't really sound like a free market approach to the economy, right? It sounds more like a planning approach. We gotta trick people into spending, and then that'll juice things up. Well, that's more or less, that was the policy. So now, if that's going to be the policy, well, that practically builds in bailouts. Because if a major firm is about to go under or at least see its stock price fall dramatically, this is going to undermine the whole wealth effect strategy. This will bring down the stock market. This will bring down stock prices. And the wealth effect is intended to raise stock prices. So if there is some major bit of financial news, like such and such firm is going down and this firm is going down, this will undermine their whole program. So they will have to bail them out to preserve their policy of the wealth effect. Well, maybe we're being too hard on them. Because maybe all this intervention and bailouts, or at least the prospect of bailouts, and this wealth effect of ginning up the stock market and getting stock prices up, maybe at least it yielded us some kind of good side effects, right? Maybe the job market was robust, or at least there's something to show for it. And yet, from January 2000 to January 2007, the net increase in breadwinner jobs in the United States was zero. They have nothing to show for themselves. After putting us through the whole nightmare of the housing bubble and everything else, they have nothing to show for themselves. He says, this again, Stockman, the only thing that has happened on the job creation front over the last decade is a massive expansion of the bedpan and diploma mill brigade. That is employment in nursing homes, hospitals, home health agencies, and for-profit colleges. In fact, this complex accounts for the totality of American job creation since the late 1990s. And then he notes that when we consider the entire period from 2000 to 2012, there's been a net gain of 18,000 jobs a month. Just the growth rate in the labor force is eight times that. This is what the... So now remember, we are criticized for being not sophisticated enough, and we don't do enough mathematical modeling, and maybe we're too stupid to understand all their sophisticated stuff and all that. But if you have a record like that, wouldn't you after a while say, maybe we're the ones who are kind of winging it? Like maybe our critics have a little... Like, how bad would things have to be before you would say, maybe we're making things worse? And meanwhile, while all this has been was going on, the vast majority of mainstream commentary consisted of what kind of bailout should occur and to what extent. That was the extent of the discussion. What kind of bailout and to what extent? It was not bailout or not. We all know, all the civilized people know we need to bail out. So this is why it's so important. The Mises Institute is so important and the work we're doing is so important. Everybody in this room. Because we actually are presenting something that's different from the mainstream. And it actually brings to mind the last presidential debate, Republican debate of 2008, when it was down to just Romney, McCain, Huckabee, and Ron Paul. And they were sitting around this little table. And 90% of the debate was taken up with McCain and Romney arguing about who was going to withdraw how many troops from Afghanistan when. So it was, well, I'm going to withdraw 10,000 troops 10 years from now. And then the other one says, hey, well, wait a minute. The other day you said it was going to be 9,000 9.5 years from now. The most trivial, innate. So finally, Ron Paul speaks up and says, "What? Well, this is the stupidest debate in the history of mankind. I mean, the whole debate takes for granted the wisdom of the policy. Like, nobody actually says, maybe we shouldn't do this. And so then afterward, they go to establishment man David Gergen. And they say, David, what do you think was the highlight of the debate? Well, I think it was when McCain challenged Romney on his withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. Obviously, Ron Paul saying, hello, am I in an insane asylum here? Is this the Twilight Zone? That was obviously the highlight of the debate, but it's the job of David Gergen to pretend that never happened. So he's actually excellent at that. All right, so that's like a short, like half hour-ish, 45-minute-ish overview of the basic nuts and bolts of what happened and how federal government regulation plus ginned up money supply and Austrian business, all this comes together. And then what happened in the wake of it? We got the bailouts and all this. But now I want to look at this from a little bit of a distance and ask, what exactly is it that the Austrians think is happening when there is an economic downturn? Like, what's actually going on? Is it that the economy is like a giant number? And when we have a downturn, it's just like that number is falling. And so what we need to do is come up with some policy to get that number back up again. Well, that isn't the way we look at it at all. Like, we would view this as a ridiculously simplistic understanding of what's happening. It's not that there's some number that fell, and we just have to do whatever manipulation is necessary to get that number back up. The Fed was great at that. They got all kinds of numbers going way up. But as we saw, there was absolutely no result from it in the long term. So what is it that we're saying? Well, to understand this, I want to use a kind of a discussion that Milton Shapiro uses in an old obscure book on the foundations of the market price system. I like that little book. And he says, let's think about two different types of economies. Like, one of them would be the type of economy that was introduced to you right at the beginning of this week, the Robinson Crusoe economy, where there's one person in the whole economy. Well, in that case, you don't have the type of issues arise that you have with an extended, sophisticated, modern economy with many, many, many millions and billions of people in it. If you're just one person, you know what you want. So you just go find it or make it, and then you consume it. It isn't a question of trying to figure out, well, what are the consumers going to want, and what's the least cost way of delivering it to them? You are the consumer. So if you want berries, you go pick them and you eat them. And so that problem doesn't arise. Or even if there are two or three people, well, you can probably get a kind of a sense, roughly, of what these people are going to want, and you figure out some way to supply it to them. Or if you have a tribe, again, with a tribe, you probably know everybody face to face. You can have some kind of rough estimate, sort of what, not perfect, but you have a sense of what people are going to want. You go combine resources and you produce it. But we don't have that luxury of sort of knowing what has to be produced, because we live in a division of labor economy, a highly extended division of labor economy. And in our economy, the producers and the consumers are not the same people. Robinson Crusoe produced the berries and ate the berries. But now, well, you could produce berries even if you hate berries. You sell them to somebody else who wants them. So producers and consumers are not the same people. And so then the question becomes, when we have firms that are going to produce stuff, they have to ask themselves, what should we produce? What do people want? In an extended modern division of labor economy, you don't automatically know the answer to that question. What should we produce? How much of it should we produce? Where should we produce it? And how do we produce it? There are countless wants out there to be satisfied that using your entrepreneurial judgment, you say, well, I think this is a want that people have, and now how do I go about satisfying that want? And how do I go about satisfying it in a least cost manner? That's the economic calculation issue. How do we make sure that resources are not being used up in the production of less urgent wants at the expense of more urgent ones? And it's also not just a question of what consumer goods do I produce and what methods do I use, but also what kind of time dimension is attached to the investment projects that I choose. I could choose to open a bakery and just sell cupcakes. Or I could choose to invest in research and development, which will bear fruit only many years in the future. Or I could produce some intermediate good that is necessary for the production of a consumer good. And where I'm going to come down in this array of possible investment projects is going to be determined by things like, for example, the interest rate. That's going to help me decide what sorts of projects are going to wind up being profitable and which are not. The public does not have an unlimited tolerance for waiting. The public does not want all entrepreneurs to engage in super long-term production, in which these entrepreneurs are using up consumer goods and producing stuff for the long term, and meanwhile, we just have to sit here and wait for the stuff to be ready. We don't want that much. We sort of give a kind of feedback mechanism by our saving, our abstention from consumption, and this gives rise to entrepreneurial decision-making about what types of investments should I make. Should it be short-term, long-term, medium-term? So this all seems like an impossible problem. And if it weren't for the price system, it would be an impossible problem. But the point of all this is that the array of consumer demands that exist out there manifest themselves through purchasing by consumers. And entrepreneurs figure out, get a sense of what consumer demand is, and the consumer demand helps to give rise to the prices of all the producer goods that combine to create the finished consumer good. So you have a whole structure that's built up. I alluded to this on the first night. A whole structure that's built up by which the desires of the consumers are transmitted throughout the production structure. Now, if those desires of consumers are not able to be transmitted, or they're transmitted with a lot of white noise in the background, it's going to lead entrepreneurs to make the wrong sorts of decisions. They'll produce the wrong kinds of things at the wrong time or in the wrong quantities, and things won't match up. The extent to which people are willing to save will not match up with the extent to which they want to consume. And so, therefore, when an Austrian looks at a downturn, the Austrian view is not that some absolute number has fallen. It's that the configuration of the whole production structure is out of whack. It needs to be brought back into some kind of rational integration. And so this interlocking series of prices can perform its function successfully, this coordinating function, only if it's not tampered with by non-market actors. Who would those non-market actors be? Well, the Federal Reserve is an example of a non-market actor because, as you've seen this week, when it interferes with interest rates, it interferes with the process of entrepreneurial decision-making. And entrepreneurs will make decisions they wouldn't otherwise have made that are bad decisions and that do not yield the array of goods and do not yield a production structure that's in line with people's desires to consume and to save. And so what we're looking at then is not, well, gee, a number has fallen. Let's see what we can do to get that number back up. It's not that there was more and now there's less. Instead, it's that the structure doesn't correspond to consumer desire. So the recovery process then has to involve allowing consumer demands to make themselves felt up and down the structure of production without any white noise. Well, what kind of white noise might we see? Well, the Federal Reserve continuing to inflate the money supply. Again, this interferes with interest rates. Again, this interferes with entrepreneurial decision-making. And this just prolongs the problem. And the problem, again, is not we need more stuff. The problem is what kind of stuff do we need? And by falsifying interest rates, you lead people to make the wrong decisions in terms of the type of stuff and what stages the stuff belongs in and so on should be made. So fiscal stimulus is sometimes proposed. Now, monetary stimulus, you can already see. If false signals, or I hate to use the word signals, forget that's erase that. If falsified interest rates have yielded us a situation in which we went from prosperity and now to recession, then obviously more of what caused that problem is not going to solve it. But then we're told, well, what about just spending a lot of money, like borrowing it and spending it, borrowing the money and spending it on bridges or a new stadium or something? Wouldn't that solve the problem? But again, that you see, when the problem is that things are arranged wrongly, merely pumping spending through the system doesn't arrange them correctly. In fact, it arranges them even more wrongly than they were originally arranged, because now you have all these politically driven projects that are now being undertaken. And moreover, I have a page on my site. I gave a talk in Houston earlier this year, so I made up a page on my site, tomwoods.com/Houston, and on that page I've linked to some interesting work by non-Austrians questioning whether fiscal stimulus actually yields you what you want. Because you sometimes hear that if the federal government spends this extra money, then there's a fiscal multiplier. So every dollar it spends yields us $2.50 of awesomeness. And actually now, the Austrian view is there is no such thing as this fiscal multiplier. But it's interesting to note non-Austrians who have been looking at this, who have said, well, actually what looks to be the case is that in the short term, the fiscal multiplier is zero, and in the long term, the fiscal multiplier is -2.3. So the government spends a dollar, and $2.30 worth of stuff is destroyed. How would that be a way of recovering? But of course, our view is that if we really want to recover, we have to solve that initial problem of figuring out we're the producers, and we got consumers out there. We got to figure out what they want. And the way to figure that out is to bring as much of economic life under economic calculation as we possibly can. And that means as little government spending as you can possibly get away with. Because every time the government spends, it spends outside the arena of economic calculation. So anyway, so I refer you to those little studies because they're quite interesting about austerity and so on. Bob Murphy has done excellent work on Canada, which did the exact opposite of what people would recommend. They had hugely unmanageable debt. The Wall Street Journal in 1995 said, Canada has now become an honorary member of the Third World because its debt was so bad. And then they dropped spending. They turned the deficit into a surplus. They had spending cuts to tax cuts in the ratio to tax increases in a ratio of 5-1. They had 11 consecutive budget surpluses. The debt-to-GDP ratio was cut in half. And then they outperformed all the other G7 countries in economic growth. So now there are always reasons the Keynesians will have, well, this is not relevant because there were these mitigating factors or whatever. But as Bob points out, when you ask the Keynesians for an actual example, all right, well, then show us then. If every example we show you of a country that cuts its spending and does well doesn't count for some reason, like you've always got some ad hoc explanation for why that one doesn't count, that one doesn't count, give us yours and we'll see if yours count. And theirs are always, well, the Great Depression would have been worse if we hadn't done this. Or the current panic would have been worse if we hadn't. Well, okay, well, as soon as you invent your time machine, we can go do controlled testing, and we'll go through once, but when we don't do it, then we'll go again. That just assumes that you're right, that your analysis is right. Like, how could that really be proof? And of course, it's not. Sometimes we're told that we're wrong also, not just because we want to cut spending in the face of a recession, but that we don't want to stimulate consumption. That shows how stupid we are. You got to get consumption going, man. Got to get consumption going. Well, a lot of times when you're dealing with Austrian business cycle, the problem is not that you don't have enough consumption. A lot of times the problem is that there has been malinvestment in various long-term projects and not enough saving to support them. So as Rothbard says in his famous Economic Depressions, Their Cause and Cure, he says that actually in that case, what you really need is more saving to validate the investments of the boom period. But maybe I'm being unfair to use this thought experiment. But let's suppose we follow the advice that what we need is just consumption, right? That if we just had a lot of consumption, that would get things going again. So let's imagine a situation in which we consume everything. We do not save and productively expend anything at all. So you buy a case of beer, and the liquor store owner then buys five new shirts, and then the owner of the shirt store buys a gold chain, and the gold chain, the jewelry store guy buys something else. And so the money just passes from person to person to person to person, and inventories are just depleted. And meanwhile, no payroll is paid, because payroll is not consumption. No business-related bills are paid. That's not consumption. No wholesale orders are placed. No intermediate goods are purchased. That's not consumption. We just consume. All we would do is just deplete inventories and destroy the entire structure of production. That's what would happen. And the structure of production, I mean, that's most economic activity is actually not captured in GDP. It's all these intermediate stages, and we wouldn't be funding any of them if all we do is consume. So yes, if you want to revert to barbarism, then all you would want is consumption. Obviously, you need some saving and productive expenditure. And then finally, my last thing, I won't get into sticky prices and wages, although I'm very interested in that subject. But finally, Bob mentioned this very briefly. Well, finally, we'll be told idle resources is the problem. This is why you need to intervene when there's a downturn. So if it's not one explanation, it's another. It's idle resource. I mean, look at that factory. It's just sitting there. It's so pathetic, just sitting there. It's not producing any widgets. And look at this poor guy with no job. And yeah, we understand the broken window fallacy, they'll say. But look, there is no opportunity cost to employing this guy in this factory, because it's not like this factory is doing something else in the meantime. It's just sitting there. This is free. Just get the government to, who cares where it gets the money? Just spend it on this and you'll just get the thing. So again, the idea sort of is the economy is like a blob that just stopped and we got to just start it. It's a big number that fell. Let's just get it going again. And so the Austrian insight is to disaggregate all this and say, well, the economy is not like a big thing. It's an interlocking series of interesting, productive things. And so the idle resource objection, that what we need is just spend some money, get the thing rolling again, what that takes for granted that this structure that we have producing stuff is already sound. There's nothing wrong with it. We just need to crank it up again. But that begs the whole question. What if the economy we have now is all screwed up because the Fed has misled people into making the wrong sorts of investments, so all our productive assets are all in the wrong configuration? So you can't just keep cranking that up because it's not going to work anymore. Like, for example, in the 1920s, from April 1924 to October 1929, annualized, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is seeing a 30% annualized growth. Now, compare that to the entire period, 1900 to 2012, where you had 5% annualized growth. Is it reasonable to think that that could have gone on forever in the 1920s, that there was nothing amiss with that economy? There were no resource misallocations. That was perfectly normal growth. But what you see when you talk about this idle resource thing is they claim there's this output gap, that here's where the economy was going before the recession. Now look at it. See, the big number is going down. We have to imagine, what if it had continued on that path? And then, see, it's actually here. It could have continued here. This is the output gap. Isn't that too bad? So we got to just spend some, get people spending and get crank up the machine again. We'll get back up here. But this just begs every interesting question. This assumes that this path was sustainable in the first place, where the capital structure is all where it ought to be, and you know, to the extent that we can't be perfect, but it's at least reasonable. But what if that's not the case? This is not even raised, because the people raising it never even consider the possibility that monetary policy could yield you that type of an outcome where you have productive resources where they do not, where they don't belong. And then finally on this, the reason resources are idle would also be worth questioning. Why are they idle all of a sudden? Answer, could it be that previously there was an artificial boom that led to all this artificial expansion? And so maybe that we don't want them to go into it. Maybe they shouldn't have been built in the first place. Or what they're doing is sitting there waiting to see where they fit now into the structure of production. Prices need to fluctuate to make it worth their while to start up again. When you see, I forget whose example this is, but when you see men's shirts sitting on a shelf in a clothing store, does it make sense to say those shirts are idle? They're not serving any productive purpose whatsoever, and so we need to stimulate purchases of the shirts. And it's true that if any shop owner could sell all those shirts tomorrow, if he dropped the price to 5 cents a shirt. But he obviously values holding back the shirts and waiting to see what the demand will be or to see where this all fits in people's desires to consume. And that's the way we ought to think in terms of idle resource. So what does this mean in short? It means in short that the proper approach in the wake of a downturn is to understand how it occurred in the first place, which is the opposite of the Krugman approach, because Krugman actually said he's sick and tired of how many people are asking how we got in this mess, and instead of asking how do we get out of it. Those two things are interrelated. But secondly, when people say, you Austrians just think we should do nothing, that's not true. It depends on who we mean by we. We think they should do nothing. They should stop doing what they're doing, but we need to pick up the pieces. We need to recover from the wreckage. We need to do entrepreneurial calculation to figure out, okay, now in the wake of all this wreckage, where do things go? Where should labor, different types of labor go? How are the expenditure streams going to recover? We have to do all that forecasting. We have plenty to do. They have done quite enough already. Okay, that's...